on campus
and online.
Online.
This is URN.
Right, we are here for the film show. Hopefully this mic is all working. It's got a red band on it rather than a white one for the light, but hopefully we're all live and ready. And I've got a bit of, over Skype, we've got my co-host here. Hello, are we doing okay? Lily, can you hear me?
Hi, sorry, you were just a bit patchy.
Oh, right,
sorry.
No worries. That should fix itself, hopefully, at some point. So it's the Time to Film show this week. And obviously, because on Sunday there was the old Oscars, and if you didn't hear our Oscars kind of Best Picture rundown, that was last week, and that is up as a podcast on our usual URN feed. We're just gonna have maybe a little kind of chat about the Oscars, because I think neither of us really, there were no real shockers there, except for maybe Best Actor. I think we can talk a bit about that.
I think that's understandably quite a fair comment.
Because I mean, generally it was, there were no kind of sweeping, nobody really swept the Oscars. Lots of kind of films had three or four winners. But, you know, speaking of Best Actor, because, I mean, I suppose it's the big news story around it. It is really news. It's almost as if that they set up the entire ceremony, you know, to give Chadwick Boseman the Oscar, and it went to Hopkins, who couldn't actually be there. Which, I mean, as I haven't watched The Father, he could be absolutely wonderful in it. And obviously, obviously the Academy were kind of, you know, whether they... I don't actually know how the Academy works.
I don't either. Yeah. And I think this almost kind of revealed that possibly they don't as well.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's messy. Like another group voted for Best Actor. Like, they did it.
it's very bizarre, because a lot of the discourse around it has been like, oh, so they don't know who's going to win ahead of the night, but surely they must do.
Because they have to print the envelopes or something.
Maybe they don't. I mean, because they quite clearly restructured the ceremony, so we got to Best Actor at the end today, which is unusual. We don't normally end there. And they clearly kind of wanted to do that because, obviously, that was the category Chadwick Boseman was in. And, you know, presumably had he won the Oscar, they would have kind of been able to sort of like almost like insidiously end on a celebration of his life. I say insidiously because I feel that the way they've treated Chadwick Boseman's death at the Oscars has actually been very sort of a bit gross in a couple of ways. I think really the best thing they could have done, honestly, would just be, you know, kind of just do the standard sort of remembrance pack, you know, of footage and people talking about him and, you know, people who respected him in the industry. I think that probably would have been best. Instead, they seem to have made a gold head of him and put it in a bag, which is a bit odd. Not as a singular bag. That sounds really weird. They made these, for anyone listening who doesn't know, they made these sort of gold heads of Chadwick Boseman that they put in kind of like gift bags for Oscar attendees. And there's a whole scandal around how the head was made in the first place, but it's just a bit odd because it's sort of like 50% of the proceeds go to a charity that helps people with colon cancer, which is unfortunately, of course, what Chadwick Boseman passed away from. But then 50% is profit. So profiting from someone's death, it's a bit dubious. I think we can all say that.
Yeah, they seem to have mishandled it in almost all the ways possible.
Yeah, really. And I feel that's really been a really, really bad look for the Oscars this year. A lot of people have really disliked that, myself included. And as you say, they very much catered the ceremony to have him at the end. And then, of course, it went to Anthony Hopkins, which apparently the deal with that as well is that he didn't want to go because, you know, he's 83 and there's a global pandemic happening. I'm sure, you know, he's had some vaccines at some point by now, but, you know, if he doesn't want to travel, that's his right. And apparently his representatives basically pleaded for him to do, if he won, or if they knew he was going to win, I don't know, but if he wanted to do his acceptance over Zoom, and the Academy wouldn't allow it. So the Academy is really kind of showing themselves up here as, you know, not moving ahead with the times in many ways. much as they would like to celebrate that by having our, of course, second female director winning the directing Oscar, which is fantastic, really great work from Chloe Zhao. Second in 93 years is a bit low, but, you know, it's still a win. Yeah, so we'll have it.
Yeah, oh yeah. Do you want to take some of the little victories?
Yeah.
I'm sure. Just fingers crossed those little victories are going to get more and more frequent. I mean...
Yeah, fingers crossed. Yeah.
But yeah, obviously, we were talking about Sound of Metal last show, and winning Best Sound. I think that's kind of...
Yeah, that's great.
One of the most obvious ones on there. Of course, Fight For You from Judas and the Black Messiah, which we played in the show, which is a fantastic track, and that won Best Original Song, which is really good. Thinking as well... Oh, I suppose there's Promising Young Woman as well. Which,
yeah, that's true, actually. That won Best Screenplay.
Yes. Which, I know...
Which... I was going to say, I know I gave a sort of like lukewarm review of it last week just because I kind of wish it pushed everything a bit further, but I still think it's a really good win. My kind of hope with Promising Young Woman is it will then open the doors to other, perhaps more nuanced and maybe more incisive work.
That's what I see.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Because all that we talk about the Oscars, it isn't going to have some of the, well, I say edgier, some of the like, I mean, from what you were saying, Promising Young Woman, it seems like the edges have been sanded off a little bit. It's lost its...
Just a smidge, yeah. Yeah.
And obviously, you know, that is the Oscars, kind of, is it being a widely nominated film.
Yeah.
But, you know,
It's still a great experience. I just wish parts of it had been pushed more. And I think, like I said last week, content like I May Destroy You is pushing that boundary more. And I think almost it, Promising Young Woman's politics is perhaps from, I don't know, maybe like 7 years ago instead of now. So, I don't know. It needs to catch up a little bit. But the Academy is slow. So, you know, this is good for the Academy and hopefully, you know, obviously great for, you know, female filmmakers and production companies and actresses as well. And so I'm really hoping that this will then kind of spur on just even more of this kind of content. I think that'd be really, really great.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. And, you know, we can only hope.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm just having another look. I mean, obviously, we had a kind of a decent chat about it in our Oscars special. So I keep clicking the wrong thing on the screen. It's weird being back in the studio. I just don't have control over the mouse. But obviously, one thing I, you know, is best cinematography for Mank. And I really... That kind of muddiness in Mank, I didn't like at all. It's strange for me that one. I know it's, you know, lauded. There are some like really nice kind of allusions to kind of old cinema with some of the shots and some of the fade-ins and crossfades and whatever. But I think generally it looked a bit naff to me, the actual cinematography.
This seems to be a theme with you and David Fincher films, though. He does add a bit of grit in there, doesn't he?
And it just seems to put like a barrier between me and the film, as if, you know.
Yeah, I can see that in some ways.
Do that already, but I just don't get on with it at all. I suppose that I'm kind of in the minority though, because apparently David Fincher is everybody's favourite. but yeah. And actually, we will talk a bit about the best documentary feature, best documentary, My Octopus Teacher. You know what? I mean, I'm trying to think. Is there anything else we want to talk about Oscars wise? Because again, we had a long chat about it in the Oscars
special. Yeah.
As I said, there's nothing incredibly surprising there, and obviously, it's hopefully a sign of things to come with a more diverse set of winners and nominees. But yeah, I, actually, because I watched it literally this morning, I thought I'd chat a bit about the best documentary, because, you know, it's not really talked about much, the documentary category. Like, I can't even remember what it was last year. I remember Free Solo, possibly, was a few years ago.
Yeah, I think that was the year before last, maybe.
But it's a category that I never, you know, really pay attention to, which is a shame, because, you know, I do like a good documentary. I mean, doesn't everybody, but this year, My Octopus Teacher won, and that's been out for a while. It's kind of been on the Netflix front page for about a year, I think I remember. But yeah, so I watched it this morning, and I can't really see why it won. My Octopus Teacher is essentially a very kind of stripped down basic thing. It's It is a story of a filmmaker, kind of nature filmmaker, documentarian, who's burnt out, and he lives in a lovely seaside house with his family, and finds an octopus on a dive, and every day he goes back to the octopus and bothers it. Honestly, he doesn't poke it quite, but he just kind of gets too close, and he can get... And that's maybe, like, my, you know, me not quite getting why it works as a film, because to me it doesn't at all, because essentially it's just pieces to camera of this bloke talking about, you know, talking about what this octopus is doing and how smart octopi, there we go. That's a plural. octopi, and how smart they are, and going into it, I was like, okay, so he's kind of burnt out, but he's still, you know, he's got his £3,000 waterproof watch on, so it's going to be like a commentary on kind of these burnt out filmmaker types who, you know, they look for meaning in meaningless things. They go under the water and find this octopus, and they're essentially projecting everything on this octopus, like from the everything. But I don't know whether it's really holding its cards close to its chest. But the actual film itself didn't come across as that at all. It just seemed like quite a straightforward look at one man's relationship to an octopus that he finds, and which I suppose, you know, we all bring things to films and bring things away from films.
Very true.
But it the fact that I don't think that the film was going for that analysis of this man is simply projecting all of his fears and anxieties about his family and his work life and his work life balance. Because he's saying at the start of the film, you know, he hadn't slept properly for months and months, and you see he's generally burnt out and emotional. And you're going into this underwater world where rather than it being an exploration of the bloke really and his family, it kind of turns just into a nature documentary with this person who is a bit too who's personifying the octopus a bit too much. I mean, probably because he is projecting, like, even if he isn't commenting on the film, he's projecting himself onto it, with him doing the David Attenborough voiceover to a certain extent.
So is it sort of about the octopus, or is it kind of about the relationship he builds with the octopus, if there is such a relationship? I'm trying to kind of like ascertain, because I've not seen it.
It is more about the octopus.
That's fascinating.
Sensation, like, a strange thing, because you'd expect it to be, you know, about that relationship. Again, how he's reflected in the octopus and brings his own feelings to it. But it's just a lot about an octopus.
Is it in some ways, though? I mean, because I say this as someone who's kind of had... I mean, a pet is not the same as an octopus. I'm also slightly afraid of octopi. But, you know, I've had lifelong relationships with animals, and I can understand that that's a very strong bond at times. And I wonder whether, if this was a kind of bond that he felt a lot of kind of strength in, whether it's focused on the octopus because it's maybe... Does it kind of feel like a love letter to the octopus?
To a certain extent. I mean, it's through a lot of the film, it is kind of trying to talk about the octopus's actions. The guy is trying to explain them in a way where, you know, he's personifying it, and presumably, well, not presumably, and when he's interacting with this octopus, he is saying, like, it's almost responding to him and liking him, you know, it's going out and wants to be pet or whatever, you know, it wants to have a relationship with him. But in the actual film itself, you know, it's talking about, you know, specific bits where the octopus is getting food and being attacked by a shark, and you can see, like, the man is describing it in a more emotive way than a documentary film, in which, you know, but it's halfway in between that feeling of, you know, there is a genuine kind of bond there, and that, you know, totally objective nature documentary thing. I don't think it quite goes into the actual strength of the actual bond itself. I don't think it's strong enough to carry the film on the aspect that, you know, this man is befriending or feeling, you know, love for this octopus in a way as a pet and as a companion almost, because you know he's driving there every day, he's obviously, you know, he burnt out and he's finding companionship. But I think, and it's a very short film, I think it's around 70 minutes or so.
Oh wow.
70, yeah, maybe 80 minutes, but I don't think it generally shows the strength of the bond in a way which would keep me occupied with the film. Like I was, you know, kind of slightly detached from the film because it wasn't, you couldn't quite see the strength of emotion and the strength of the bond that I would have liked. And obviously, it did, you know, it won Best Documentary, so I'm not saying like I'm the only person who have an opinion on it, but I couldn't get what I thought would be the point of the film. It is that that exploring this bond and why this man feels so strongly about it, and instead it's kind of wishy-washy and maybe pushing too far on the objective kind of nature documentary stuff rather than. It's like Jaws. Jaws being, you know, is Jaws the film about the shark, or is Jaws the film about the reaction to the shark? To me,
yes,
this is kind of a film about the octopus rather than the film about the reaction to the octopus. It's on a, and obviously, you know, it probably will need a rewatch from me because I was quite detached from it, like I couldn't quite get into it. Maybe also in a way where. I know, like, a lot of podcasts from, like, Los Angeles where they start talking about, you know, posh things and whole foods and my brain switches off because it's like,
yes.
I don't get this in the world and I suddenly feel just completely detached. And
you just kind of zone out.
£2,000 watch and lovely beach house and him making a whole film about its relation to an octopus. I got detached from that. So, obviously, a rewatch might be in order, but I was getting it as a very, very basic film that I couldn't get much actual nuance from it at all in the relationship. Yeah.
That's fair. I think it sounds interesting. I've not seen it, and I'm kind of interested in watching it now, just because I feel like I have heard so much about it as well. Like, I feel like I've just heard like the name My Octopus Teacher for like well over a year, and I just haven't got round to it. I just haven't looked at it. So I kind of am surprised that suddenly it's a big deal and it's you know won the best Oscar for the best documentary Oscar. So yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of intrigued by it.
I'm surprised with how big a deal it kind of has turned out to be.
I think that's.
This to me is kind of the thing you put on, you know, on BBC at 3 p.m. on New Year's Day or something.
Ooh, like it's damning.
For the sofa. It's a film for the sofa. It's a film to play Monopoly to. It's not
okay.
The best documentary feature.
Not the best documentary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'll have to give it a go for sure.
Oh yeah. I mean, well, I suppose the question is, do I recommend it? It is a, you know,
yes.
It's a pretty tight film. It is short, and it is beautiful. Some of the actual, you know, saying that. All the nature things about the film, you know, it's some beautiful nature documentary filmmaking, and it's probably some of the best out there of that kind of undersea world and nice coral reef things. I think it's called a forest at one point. Like the it's a lovely looking film, but it was to me just that surface level. As I said, you know, give it a go. Again, it's not too much of a time thing, you know, but maybe to me, don't expect it to be as deep as you'd think a documentary, a best documentary winner would be. And that is on Netflix, and it's been on Netflix for a while, so I'm sure quite a few people have watched it. But I mean, I only just got around to it because I thought, you know, it's one of the winners, and and I hardly ever get around to the documentary winners. But there we go. And what I might do is play a track, and then we're going to talk a bit about some 90s films.
Yes.
A bit of a transition over to that, but but yeah, because we thought, you know, do something fun, because talking about Oscars all the time and about the nuances of the actual Academy system and how bad they are doing a lot of stuff, kind of get you down a bit. But so we're going to get to some lovely 90s. Films. So you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna put on a track. Right, I'm gonna go for the Titanic track. So I think we're gonna talk about Titanic and trying to show how it's been cruelly attacked over the past two decades or so. When it's, I mean, I actually haven't watched it. which is a crime.
Honestly, that's such a crime. I can't be friends with you now.
Yeah, I mean probably it's because I always think, you know, it's 15 hours long and it's a basic romance with nothing else.
Like, it is very long. Like, yeah.
That's the prevailing opinion that I got from everybody else.
I'm going to have such a defence for this.
You chat about it. But you know what? We're here to take a break from me talking. We're going to do a bit of Celine Dion. Of course, it is My Heart Will Go On. So here we go. I love this track. It's cheesy, but you know, I'm going to absolutely blast the speakers in the studio, because this is a wonderful one. Here we go. My Heart Will Go On.
This is University Radio Nottingham.
Celine Dion, with of course My Heart Will Go On, and we're back with a bit of the film show, and we're going to talk, of course, about the film that song is from, which is a bit of Titanic. And Lizzie, I know you want to really, you know, hype up Titanic and try and dispel my passive feelings about it, that it isn't good.
Yeah, I do. I feel like it's really interesting to talk about Titanic, because talking about like the Oscars, for example, this is a film that did really, really well at the Oscars. Titanic has 11 Oscars, which I think is only rivaled by something like Return of the King, I think. I think that has 11 Oscars as well. Maybe 9 or 11. It's a lot, basically. Has a lot of Oscars. And yet over the years, Titanic has kind of become to be viewed as like a guilty pleasure. And I'm absolutely convinced that this is rooted in a dislike for and distrust of things that are marketed towards women. Because Titanic is ultimately, in many ways, a romance film. As you were saying previously, it's got a romance in it. And the romance is not why I like Titanic. I'll get into why I like it. But the basic romance, of course, is there between Rose and Jack, and that's kind of, it's all very, it's very melodramatic and quite Downton Abbey-ish, which I also feel is justified, because if you've not seen Titanic, which you've actually not, it's built within a frame narrative. Which it's a long frame narrative, I have to say, but the opening is that people are going to look for the wreck of the Titanic, and they want to find this necklace called the Heart of the Ocean that Rose DeWitt Picator had, and they're actually kind of on this modern day boat kind of going down with submarines to the wreck and everything, and they've got the real the Rose who survived the Titanic with them. She's much older, she's like 80. Well, no, she can't, because she says it's been 84 years and she must be like 18 in the film. So she's probably like over 100, but just go with it. She's old. And she tells them the story of the Titanic. So what you're going into is not like a realistic drama. You're going into an older woman's memory of a very different time. I mean, like sort of even just visually, you know, you're going back from like the 90s, from the original, from the frame narrative of the 90s, way back into like the Edwardian era, which is so vastly different historically that when you go back in time, it does automatically become really melodramatic. But that melodrama and that romance is really one of the things that has made it viewed as for the women and thus bad, because it was enjoyed by many a teenage girl who, you know, fancied Leonardo DiCaprio, which is their right. And, you know, I can understand that it's garnered this reputation, although I think that's a really poor view of teen girls and female audiences as is. I don't think that that's fair at all. But what I like about Titanic so much, it is such a well-made film. Like, I was always one of the kids who's, like, really interested in the Titanic, so I know a lot about it, and it's a bit worrying, to be honest. It's one of those kind of lifelong things. Someone can mention it to me, and I'll be like, oh, did you know this and this and this? And I don't know. I've always liked it. I've always been interested in it. And it's such a well-researched film. They've really made all the sets kind of to the absolute T. They've looked at all the sister ships of the Titanic and all the photographs that were remaining and really made everything absolutely spot on in terms of the replication of the Titanic. I mean, when you really think about it, this is one of the biggest maritime disasters in history, and certainly one of the most well-known maritime disasters in history. And to make a film about it is such a high concept thing. and you've really, really got to get it right. And it absolutely succeeds. You can feel the absolute scale of the boat, and you, well, ship rather, sorry, it's a ship, it's not a boat. but you can feel the size of the ship and the absolute scale, and you can feel the kind of awe around it as well. You know, the people were so impressed by it, you know, before they knew what it would become, and how kind of, you know, that obviously eventually slowly throughout the film goes, you know, downhill. And it, even in the melodrama, I feel the melodrama is what obviously is meant to make you invested in it, because you have to have people on the ship that you don't want to die, basically, because you know where it's going. And I do feel it's kind of successful. I feel like every time you get to like the midway point and someone goes, iceberg right ahead, and you kind of just want them to go, oh, please don't. Like, it's just, I just want them to be happy and in love. And, you know, it is effective in how it uses the drama. But I really feel that it's kind of, I don't know, I just feel like so many of the technical aspects get overlooked because of, like, the romance and because of like the Celine Dion song and how it's become in pop culture. It is an incredibly well done film. I really urge anyone who, especially anyone who's interested in film, to go and watch the behind the scenes work on this film, because it's so interesting to watch them shooting in the water tanks and like making these huge, like, you know, replicas of the ship that people were like literally like sliding down, you know, as it's sinking and stuff. And it's so well conceptualized. But I think as well, it's one of those films that for me, it just has such a distinctive feeling. Like, I can't think of another film that feels like Titanic when you sit down to watch it. Like, it's got such an amazing score. Like, obviously you've got the Celine Dion song, everybody knows, but the score by James Horner is absolutely fantastic. And I can't think of a score like it. It's like the second you hear it, your brain goes, oh, that's Titanic. And it's just, it really captures the scale of everything so well. And it sets you up for the journey you're about to go on when you sit down to watch it, whether that's through the excitement of the romance and the scale of the ship and the excitement around it all, to the eventual, you know, horror of, you know, these people dying and this unfortunate tragedy, and the real kind of like, the real tension that appears in all of that. And I also think as well, it's got such a really cool lead in Rose DeWitt-Mercator, because it's kind of interesting in that, like, she's a sort of higher class lady and she's dissatisfied with her life. She's extremely depressed. And you could see that some people would maybe think like, oh, well, she's got loads of stuff. But, you know, the reality of it is that it's highlighting the fact that during that period in time, women had like no say over what they wanted to do with their own lives. They had limited agency. They had kind of like, you know, expected marriages. She's expected to marry this guy called Cal, who's played by Billy Zane, who's of course just horrible and just really horrific. There is no kind of like, who will she pick in this film between Leo and Billy Zane? It's like, you want Leo because Billy Zane is a horrendous person. And I just think it's so interesting, because she starts out very kind of like very beautiful. She is very beautiful anyway, it's Kate Winslet, but very beautiful, very pristine, very kind of controlled because of the way the society is controlling her. And as the film unravels, all of that stuff and all the classism kind of goes out the window, except for the fact that there is the horrible issue of that they tried to put the, you know, the higher class people in the boats first, and they valued that life above lower class lives, which is true of the actual disaster and is of course really unpleasant and horrible. You shouldn't do that. But it's so interesting in how it wants to kind of look at class and to talk about it and to think about liberation for women as well, and kind of like, I don't know, just, it's just really interesting. There's such like a spirit to Rose, and even kind of towards the end of the film, she actually becomes an action heroine at one point. There's very much, for anyone who's seen it, like, you know, kind of having to go through corridors as they're slowly, like, you know, being filled with water, or quite rapidly being filled with water, actually, and having to free Jack, who's kind of tied up at one point. He's been arrested for something utterly stupid that he gets framed for that I'm not going to go into. But there's a lot of, like, axe wielding for Rose and going through all these, like, corridors and stuff. It really does suddenly become an action film about maybe three quarters of the way through, which is really where James Cameron's, like, action chops are really coming into play. So it's just such a varied film, yeah, as you can probably tell from me talking about it. And I really feel it's been done a disservice over the years. And I like to defend Titanic when I can, because I just think so much effort went into it and so much scope and attention and scale. And of course, you know, that's what got it these 11 Oscars, that I really think people should revisit it and, you know, put aside their prejudices about, you know, the melodrama and the romance and, you know, accept that that's part of, you know, the concept of returning to memory and returning to, you know, regale your stories. And just kind of enjoy it. It's a really good film. I don't know if I've sold you on it yet.
Or yeah, like... I definitely like that it's... That it's been boiled down to that melodrama and forgotten, like it's been forgotten that, you know, it obviously was a hugely, you know, a lot of effort had to be put in for to look that good. I know it is a wonderful looking film and the amount of effort they put into it. And definitely, like, yeah, it seems like the passage of time, it has just been boiled down to that melodrama and that melodrama as a bad thing rather than, as you were saying, you know, supporting those characters. So that the big action, action payoff, the actual Titanic in the Titanic is going to land, and definitely Titanic is on television probably every other week, and
I haven't seen it on TV for a long time, so I don't know which channels you're looking at, but I'd love to find them.
You know what?
Because I do love
Avatar,
Titanic.
Honestly, like, I mean, talking about that with Avatar. With that actually being flawed in probably some of the aspects that I, not watching Titanic, think, you know, oh, Titanic must be like Avatar, it must be like that with its bombastic for the sake of it. But I'm sure from definitely what you're saying, it is definitely worth, you know, a watch or even a rewatch for a reevaluation of just how good it is.
I really feel so. I don't feel it's bombastic in the way Avatar. I'm not the biggest fan of Avatar, I have to say. Although I think it's hilarious that they called their element unobtainium that they can't obtain. I think that's amazing. I wasn't the biggest fan of Avatar, even though it is quite the spectacle. It just didn't do it for me. But I feel like Titanic is a spectacle in such a different way. And yeah, I mean, they're almost like incomparable because Avatar is just such like high fantasy and like high sci-fi. Yeah. And then Avatar is obviously not Avatar. Titanic is really historically grounded.
Yes.
But I do definitely think it's worth a watch. I think as well, people really just missed it, and I just feel like, you know, if you sit and think about it for more than 5 minutes, imagine how easy it would be to make a terrible Titanic film. And there have been quite a few probably that aren't that great. And you know, if you get the CGI wrong, or it doesn't look right, or you don't get the level of horror right or the level of terror, it's going to come off as comedic, which is just, it sounds weird to say, but it will come off as completely tonally dissonant if you don't get it right. And they nail it every time. They really do.
Fantastic.
And I definitely think it's worth everyone's time and a revisit and should be considered a bit more than just a guilty pleasure by a lot of film connoisseurs.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely will have to go and check that out. I suppose it's been around for long enough.
Yes.
I thought, you know, we're going for films that, you know, feel like they've had so much effort put into them and are generally worth watching. Like, probably a completely different, you know, I don't know, a sphere where, you know, a lot, rather than being, you know, one of those that's dismissed over time. I think Jackie Brown has, which is the film we're talking about next, Jackie Brown as a Tarantino film, and just as kind of one of these wonderfully intricate plotting crime films from the 90s, and has been, you know, more and more viewed on as some of Tarantino's best work. And I've got to say, for me, it definitely is. Actually, it's one of his least watched as well. I know he's not done too many films, but Jackie Brown is certainly one of his least watched. So, as I was saying, it's a very intricately plotted film, but I'll try my best with a little bit of a synopsis, because, it really aids to it, I think, that Tarantino didn't write it, to a certain extent. I know a lot of people say, you know, he needs an editor, he needs a writer.
He does need an editor.
To be one film he needs, but honestly, right, I will, at some point I will talk about Kill Bill, and I know it's a very millennial thing to think, you know, Kill Bill is really good, but I do like Kill Bill Part 2 more than Part 1, which is probably a bad opinion.
I like Part 2 more than Part 1 as well.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
But I do like Jackie Brown more than that, which I'll get onto, which is... we've got the wonderful Pam Grier as the main character, Jackie Brown, who smuggles money and unknowingly smuggles drugs from Mexico on an airline as a flight attendant to Samuel Jackson's wonderfully played gunrunner, Ordell, in Los Angeles. And the whole plot is around Jackie Brown being actually arrested by Michael Keaton, of all people, as an FBI agent, or some kind of police agent, for the Drugs Commission, and trying to get Jackie Brown to be an informant. And the whole plot revolves around Samuel Jackson's Ordell trying to get one up on the Drugs and Crime the LAPD, I suppose, trying to get one up on them, and, you know, get sorted with because his gun running business is, you know, real small time, and he's struggling, and you can feel even how it's shot, like he is, you know, on a knife's edge. His business isn't doing great, and he just wants to have kind of one final score, and trying to use Jackie Brown, whether. As you know, a kind of a slightly naive companion or assistant to the plot, to get its one final score on the LAPD, while Pam Grier's Jackie Brown is just one of the, you know, the cleverest, sharpest characters there, who is essentially, you know, running it all by herself, and realizing. What Samuel Jackson's character is trying to do, and trying to, you know, trying to make some money herself. As I was saying, it kind of follows that kind of plan. They're trying to set that plan up into action of swindling the LAPD, effectively, which is, you know, kind of high tension. I do like to say things are heist films. I say that, like, as a genre, heist films. I can describe lots of films as heist because you got that feeling from it. I think to a certain extent Jackie Brown is, because it's got that intricately plotted kind of crime, while setting up the characters as kind of desperate. I definitely don't want to spoil too much in it, because, you know, it's got lots of, maybe not twists and turns, but lots of, again, intricately weaved character dynamics. And actually, one of my favourites, Bobby De Niro, is in here again, and I'm like, Bobby De Niro film, but playing a character unlike, you know, I think any other character Robert De Niro has played, as the kind of the jailbird Louis, who just got out of prison and is, you know, constantly, well, he's stoned a lot of the time, but also just really kind of menacingly quiet, and but also you can feel the tension within him kind of bubbling, and it's probably one of the most, I mean, with all the characters, all the violent, you know, essentially psychopaths that Robert De Niro has played, Louis in here is one of his best, and it's a very unconventional performance for him, who is kind of caught up in this plot to kind of do one last job. And I think really for me, saying it's Tarantino's best work, because it plays on, and we all know Quentin Tarantino likes his blaxploitation and his exploitation cinema in general, but him kind of, especially with Coffee, like, and all those 70s blaxploitation films, well, of course Coffee had Pam Grier, using his knowledge and the tropes from some of those, whilst portraying, you know, this Jackie Brown character as an incredibly, you know, strong character in her own right, and not falling into the misogynistic traps that Tarantino does play into, whether that's trying to replicate tropes or him genuinely being a misogynist. I think
it's a hard line sometimes.
Yes, but his use of those tropes, but also. His, you know, real vivid cinematography. You know, he likes his long shots, especially in this. And there's a shot especially in this, where the camera kind of locks down halfway across the street, and it kind of just holds in the car, and again, don't want to spoil it too much, but and people are getting in and out of cars and talking, and there's the radio on, and it's just a very restrained shot. And I think any other kind of filmmaker might try to make this film kind of as flashy and, you know, twirling around, almost, you know, heist film like Steven Soderbergh kind of thing. But really, and I wish Tarantino made more of these kind of films, like, where he can adapt someone else's work. I know this is from a 1992 book, Rum Punch. Adapt that work and use his kind of unconventional filmmaking style to really let the characters come through, without, you know, trying to shove everything in our faces. And again, I said it's probably Tarantino's best work for me, and certainly some of the best performance I've seen in films in general. Like, as I was saying, Pam Grier is wonderful in this, and the really and of course I forgot to mention another main character of the film, which is Max Cherry, played by Robert Forster. I think one of his last roles. And of course, Pam Grier and Robert Forster really weren't, you know, main leads at the time, and bringing these two wonderful actors back, and the actual the face acting in Robert Forster, like, he's such a sweet man, and I you know, it's genuinely heartbreaking how sincere he is, because he's playing this bail bondsman, which I didn't actually get what bail bonds were and whatever, like, going into the depths of, you know, gun running and bonds and informants. Is really natural in this film, I think. Like, it doesn't go out its way for trying to explain everything in some kind of botched exposition scene. It really leads you along, and it gets you emotionally tied up in the film, without it being confusingly, you know, plotted. But Robert Forster in this, as the bail bondsman, really also shines along with Pam Grier, and especially their relationship. And it's genuinely one of my favourite, you know, relationships in film, and with how sincere it is, and how strong Pam Grier is in her role, while also having that emotional depth. It is, you know, I can talk forever about this film because, again, I think it's so tightly plotted and wonderfully acted. But I would honestly say definitely go watch it. I mean, it's if you're afraid of it being a Quentin Tarantino film where it's like whatever, Death Proof, Four Rooms, it's nothing really like that, but it's one of the best uses of Tarantino, like, I've ever seen, because he didn't write it, he has an editor, he has a writer. It isn't that kind of indulgence that you'd get in lots of Tarantino films.
I'm really interested in it now, because Jackie Brown's the only one I've not seen. I feel like you've either seen Jackie Brown or Death Proof, and I've seen Death Proof.
Yes, I've
seen Four Rooms as well, which is such a time, but it's not fully his film. It's very weird as well. It's gosh, that film's very camp. It's great and terrible at the same time. But no, I'm really interested in Jackie Brown, because I didn't realise it was an adaptation. And I think I was a bit worried about the indulgence of kind of like the exploitation film genre. But now I'm really interested in that, because, yeah, I like a lot of, I mean, we all know Tarantino's got more indulgent as less people, you know, fewer people have said no, basically, and edited him. And I've always liked something like Reservoir Dogs, where he started out. I think that's a really tight film. And this sounds really, really tightly plotted. And that may be good, because he's not written it, essentially, as harsh as it sounds to say. I think you've really sold me on Jackie Brown. I think I'm going to have to go check it out.
Yeah, there we go. And I'm definitely going to check out Titanic. And I'm not quite sure where Jackie Brown is available, but I will have a look at that during this little track that we're playing, and then we'll go on to some maybe slightly more indulgent choices ourselves on some 90s films. We're going to play the opening track, and probably the most distinctive track from Jackie Brown, which is, of course, Across 110th Street, which plays over the credits in the film, by Bobby Womack. Originally from, I think, the soundtrack of a film from the 70s, I think that was also called Across 110th Street. So yeah, he's really playing off, I don't know, Tarantino has all that in his record collection that he wants to share. But this is a fantastic track, and I thought I'd play this, and we'll be back with some, you know, cheesy, maybe not cheesy, but indulgent 90s choices after this. So here we go, Across 110th Street. DJ! This
is URN University Radio.
And we're back in the last 5 minutes or so talking about some of our guilty favourites. And Lizzie, you've got an absolute cracking one here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do. So I've gone for 1999's The Mummy, which is just one of my favourite films. I just absolutely love it. Obviously, it's a remake of a much older film. I've not seen the older one, and I've not seen the new Tom Cruise one. I'm not even going near that. I'm not dealing with it. I just love this film. This film, I can't even call it like guilty pleasure because it's just such joy. Yeah. Like, it just wants to give you joy. You get joy. It's great. It's to kind of just very quickly say about it, like what it's about. Essentially, there's an adventurer called Rick O'Connell, played by Brendan Fraser, and then a librarian and aspiring Egyptologist called Evelyn. And they essentially kind of like team up with a bunch of archaeologists, inadvertently wake up an evil mummy called Imhotep, and shenanigans ensue. And that's kind of with lots of, mummies that are in the City of the Dead in Hamunaptra. And I don't want to say any more about it than that because we're getting towards the end of the show, really. But it's just such a great film. And I really enjoy it. I think Brendan Fraser's fantastic in it. I've said before, I'd love to have like a kind of resurgence of Brendan Fraser's acting because his career kind of got derailed for various other reasons that were unfair to him. And I'd love to see him come back. He seems like such a fun actor and such a very sweet person. He's just so great in this. I really feel Rick O'Connell is one of like the perfect leading men because he's so funny and charming and great. But by the time you get into the sequels as well, he's very much like the mum friend, which I can really appreciate. He's really...
Great word.
Yeah,
definitely.
He's just great. I just love that's his character. He becomes very much kind of like the protector and the organizer, but is also kind of like the suave swashbuckler. I just love that character. I think he's great. And I love Evie as well. I think this is like one of my favorite film couples of all time, essentially. She's so great. She's so well respected in the film, which is really nice to see as well from the 90s. There's so much of kind of like a sense of self-discovery for her in The Mummy. She's, like I say, she's so well respected because she understands all of the, they really need her because she understands all of the literature that they're looking at as well in the City of the Dead and all the ancient texts. And it's just great. It's funny. It's charming. It's an action adventure. It's surprisingly darker than I remembered. I remember seeing like, I was like, oh, it's a 15. I remember watching this when I was 7, but again, it does.
By scarabs.
Yes, I was going to say traumatized by scarabs is a phrase for this film. But yeah, I just love it. And I think, you know, we're talking about 90s films. This is just a perfect 90s film. Oh. And if you want something fun to go and watch and you've not seen it or you've not seen it in a while, just stick The Mummy on. It's such a great time.
Yeah, I mean, Brendan Fraser as well. It's a bit outside the 90s, but Bedazzled. I recently rewatched Bedazzled from 2000. Brendan Fraser. It's not the best film, but he's so sweet and lovely. Brendan Fraser, honestly, one of the, criminally... overlooked actors and really needs a resurgence. But yeah, I mean, on the last few minutes, I've got to talk a bit about a film that I've been watching recently, which is Bram Stoker's Dracula, which is a very high, I say camp kind of thing. It's filmmaking pushed to its very highest indulgence. I have no idea how it was made because of sheerly how... It looks both expensive and also kind of art house, but also kind of one of, like, it's looking back. The thing is, with this kind of film, you feel, Francis Ford Coppola is obviously one of the, most heralded directors ever, but it's like he's trying to bring in elements from every single film he's ever seen. It's one of the most cluttered films. like, even from the start, we've got kind of silent film with stuff with the silhouettes, very kind of Kurosawa, and it was, but like every single filmmaker under the sun, you can see influences there. It's packed full of just weird gothness. Like, it's probably one of the most goth films ever, despite it also having just the high camp kind of. Of course, Dracula himself, he has about 20 different costume changes. And Anthony Hopkins, this should be, like, they should just bring the best actor award from 20 years ago for this, because here's Van Helsing. It is one of the best.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
He's almost like, he's like like the devil has come down. Like, you know what I mean? It's such an evil performance. Well, he's obviously had such a lot of fun and just chopping people's heads off left and right. And of course, Keanu Reeves playing like he's in a completely different film, but it worked because because he's so perpetually confused. He's not meant to be perpetually confused, but that's just how Keanu Reeves acts in this film. Like, he's not quite sure that he's on set or that the camera is working. But it adds up to this incredible distinction between Anthony Hopkins, you know, just running around like, oh, like, it's incredible, right?
It sounds brilliant. The screenshot she showed us in the chat the other day looks so high camp. I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah, they say like every frame's a painting in this. Like, honestly,
yeah.
At any time, it is an absolute blast. You know, he can't write female characters. I can say that he's rubbish. It's not, you know, it's certainly not a film like it's gonna be a very. No, it's not a very progressive film, but it's got that high camp in there, and I mean, I know we're going a bit over time, but I mean, when I saw this first on the television, I generally thought they'd cut out scenes to like get it down to a 15 rating. Nope, it's just what the film is. It feels like he managed to cut down a 20-hour film into
wow.
this 2-hour beast of high camp, and I'd honestly go check that out. That is on Netflix right now. And if you want to
be I'm gonna have to watch that
to drink for you know just have a bottle of wine and honestly just laugh your way through it because it's a wonderfully campy well also you know pretty brutal and also very goth film. Right, I think that brings us to the end of the film show this week.
Yeah.
You can obviously follow us at @urn_filmshow on Instagram and Twitter. Well, I think it's been a pretty good one this show, I reckon. A bit of Oscars and
the 90s nice. Yields some good content. It really does. Yeah.
But yeah, and we're going to be putting this up as a podcast later in the week. That should be done round about Friday if I can get around to it. but hopefully we'll see you all. You'll hear us next week. And I'm going to. There is a track next. I'm not quite sure what track it's going to be. Let's say it's going to be Haunted House by Holly Humberston. That is the next track on the playlist, which hopefully is a good one. But yeah, so thanks for listening, everybody. It's been a real good one this week. So yeah, see you next week, everybody.
Bye.
On campus. And online.
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 This
is
URN.